Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are taking you to Breckenridge, Colorado, to speak with Shannon Galpin and her 14-year-old daughter, Devin Galpin-Clark, from Endangered Activism. Shannon, Devin, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. So I have to say, I am so excited to speak with both of you for multiple reasons. You know, I host this podcast. I also host a parenting podcast called Raising Adults. And the whole concept behind that podcast is that we aren't raising children. We're raising the future adults that are going to contribute to our world. And what do we want those adults to look like? And it seems to me, Shannon, that you are raising an adult given the work that you and Devin are doing together. So I am super stoked to talk with you guys today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. So let's start by, I'd love to just hear how each of you became passionate about animal conservation, and then go ahead and Devin, tell us about this incredible project that you're working on with your mom.
Okay, so I kind of got interested in animal conservation when I was like 4 years old, and I fell in love with a snow leopard. And then as I got older, I kind of started to learn how you can't just protect one species. You have to protect the habitat, and it just goes from one animal to an entire ecosystem that supports it. And how I learned about that, I learned about climate change and all these problems facing wildlife. I started to fall in love with the endangered species even more and wanted to like help save them so badly, but didn't know how to since I was so young. And when I was around 11 years old, my mom suggested the idea of our project, Endangered Activism, as a mother-daughter collaboration, trying to help endangered species and wildlife through education, outreach, and encouraging more kids to be involved with youth activism and to be aware of the world around them and trying to make a difference every day.
That's incredible. So, and Shannon, how about you?
Well, when I was about Devin's age, I remembered that my favorite book was this kind of animated or illustrated book around endangered species. And I had totally forgotten about it until Devin started falling in love with endangered species. And it'd been this kind of dog-eared book that I had just, you know, paged through. And I remember that it had all these like individual endangered species, and there was one in particular that had been the U.S. California condor, and had talked about how it was almost extinct. I think it was down to like 30 individual species or something, or you know, individual animals. And you know, that's an animal that's now come back from the brink. And I'd completely forgotten about this book until Devin exhibited the same love of animals. And it's just something that I've tried to nurture in her, just, you know, following this through. I never imagined that it was something that she would take, you know, kind of follow through so fully, from just, you know, wanting to do fundraisers to support individual species like the snow leopard. But that it grew to really understanding ecosystems and habitat and climate change, and really, when it came down to it, that we would start to collaborate on a bigger project.
Yeah, this is like a fierce follow through that she's got going on. I mean, this is way past a lemonade stand, which is what my son is currently thinking is going to be his contribution to animal conservation. So it's really incredible. So tell us about the project, because there's so many different mediums involved. And I want our listeners to just hear overall what the project's all about, but also why you chose to come at it from so many different angles.
Well, so the project started as a real mentorship where I knew that I had the skill sets from my previous work on community activism, engagement, you know, how to build an organize an organism. Yeah. How to build an organization, and how to build activism, you know, how to develop that. So I knew that Devin and I could build something together. And when we had the opportunity to pull her out and homeschool her on the road for a year, then it really dived deeper into field research. So we knew that video was going to be a major component of this. And that's really where we set out from. And the rest really kind of developed authentically and organically out of our mutual loves of storytelling. So we really started with the base of build a website, you know, we're gonna start with youth activism and storytelling, and then documentary video. And then as we were on the road and we started to really dive into the research and kind of build this out together and travel together, we started to talk about, okay, now how do we reach people? You know, and how does the storytelling really reflect our own interests and our desire to not just preach to the choir? We don't want to just keep talking to the same people that are already engaged in conservation. And that means reaching out to urban communities that don't have the touch with conservation in the same way we do. And that then really developed with two key projects. And I'm going to hand that over to Devin as to how we really authentically started to develop our other two projects besides the documentary.
So apart from the documentary, we also have a street art project. Well, now we have multiple street art projects and a graphic novel. So the graphic novel is about a teenage superhero named the Rosette, who has the ability to shapeshift into different animal species. And she uses that power to work alongside the animal kingdom to help stop the sixth extinction and to help encourage more animal conservation. So we've got that book as more of like a fun storytelling, getting kids involved, but then also like sneaking in conservation facts and actually really getting them educated about what's really going on. And then we've just launched a Kickstarter for that, which was launched on Monday. So a little bit nervous about that, but I think it's going to hopefully work. So that's really exciting. And we launched the Kickstarter recently because we really wanted to make this book bilingual, because I was raised English and Spanish from my school. So we wanted to make it bilingual and launch an English book and a Spanish book at the same time. And we also wanted to have the book be printed very eco-friendly, and we found a printer that could do that. But it would be really hard to do with normal publishing companies and normal publishers, so we decided to self-publish.
Wow.
And what was really cool was that Devin came up with the idea of the graphic novel when we were on a field research trip, because this was something that she's really into. She loves graphic novels. She loves that medium. And so she started brainstorming this idea of a superhero that could fight wildlife crime and has a snow leopard as its main sidekick, because that's, you know, her North Star. It was her whole entry point into wildlife conservation.
I'm probably like one of the biggest Marvel fans that you'll ever find. So I like, since the creation of the Rosette, I've like come up with this way to like integrate her into the Marvel universe. And like, I've come up with this whole storyline that probably will never be used, but I'm like, that's how into like superheroes I am. It's kind of an obsession.
Hey, you know, we just got to get Marvel on board. And right. Now we're making this crazy big difference. That's so cool. So did you find, as you're kind of dipping into these different mediums, because I know you've got the graphic novel, you also have street art, right? Can you just talk about that for a second?
Yeah. So we have two street art projects at the moment. We've got a collaboration with Mexican artist Diana Garcia, and the project is called What We Lose, and it's kind of giving the bigger stories behind each animal. And so we have they're pastings, they're wheat pastings, and there's three elephant designs, and then there's two jaguar designs, a sun bear, a whale, and bumblebees, right?
That's all. And a rhino.
Oh, and now we've got a black rhino. So we created those in order to kind of try to tell the story behind the animal, like how it supports its ecosystem, why it is important to conserve, and the impact they make on their habitat. So for example, the elephant we chose as one of our animals because when an elephant leaves footprints in the ground, they're deep enough that when it rains, they collect rainwater, and those footprints help sustain hundreds of different species, little small micro species and little organisms. So we decided we wanted to be able to tell that story and create that piece. So we put those up, and so now each piece isn't just art, it's also telling a story of conservation and the jaguar, like why it's the keystone species, and all of these different animals have an important story. So every time we create one of those new street art pieces, we have to research the animal, find out why it is so important. And most of them are based off field research trips we've done. So we can kind of connect them back to what we've learned. And then we also have a street art project going on with the Ai Mariposa film, which launched recently, about the borderlands and the disruption of the butterfly migrations that's happening between the United States and Mexican border. And if the border wall goes up, how those butterflies will be impacted. So we created these street art. They were also pastings, and they were like antique maps of the borderland between the United States and Mexico. And what we did is we put 3D butterflies. We glued them onto the map, and we had them going all different directions to try to show that migratory pattern and show the impact of where the border wall would be, and the gray area where the border wall would be was represented by dead butterflies to try to show the impact of that.
Wow.
And that really came out of my love of street art as something I've done and worked with a large part of my life in multiple countries, because I really believe in the power of public art and street art to bring social justice issues into public arenas. And when we started playing around with the idea, again, of how do we bring wildlife conservation issues into urban arenas, and I started talking more and more about street art with Devin, and we did a street art tour when we were in Paris, it gave Devin her first experience of doing a stencil art project. And then she started really getting into that idea of, that is something that is accessible to her, even though she didn't think of herself as an artist. She started to realize there's so many different modalities of art that are accessible as a street artist. And she started playing around with her own street art.
Cause I can't really draw, like I can't really paint. I don't have those skill sets, but, we were able to like find other ways to create art, and it's just cool being able to experience that and learn the different ways that you can create art, even if you don't think of them in the traditional ways.
And the power of collaboration.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you finding as a result of the street art and the, I mean, I just have so many questions. So you went on this tour of the world, right? You went to 17 countries in 15 months, you're homeschooling, you're doing your documentary film, and you're doing the street art. Is that right?
Yeah.
This is all kind of happening together?
Yeah.
Okay. So what, because I know the film's not out yet and the book is just now, or the graphic novel's just now being launched. So what has been the response to the street art, and what do you anticipate being the response to these other two components of the work that you're doing?
So far with the street art, what we've seen is this new outreach to urban communities and places that we have put these pastings, like Paris, Oxford, downtown Denver. We found that we're able to reach a lot more people in cities that won't have these access to wildlife and won't be able to see wildlife like this in the wild, and being able to get those stories out and being able to see that in new places is really cool. And also, what's really cool is we're able to see people reposting our street art on Instagram and sharing those with their friends and getting more and more people to see this and getting more and more people involved, which is really incredible. And every one of our street art pastings has a tag with endangered activism and hashtag what we lose, so that they can look it up and they can learn the actual story behind it and the meaning. And being able to just educate so many more people on these individual species is just really exciting for me and rewarding, because it's like, oh, here you go. Here's a new, really amazing looking, beautiful piece of art, but it's also a really cool story, and now you're going to learn something new from it.
And the knock-on effect of that, you know, the hope is that drives people to the website and they get to see more of what we're doing, where we have, you know, like a teaser video about some of the field research projects, and it kind of broadens it beyond the street art. You know, and in regards to the response with the graphic novel and the documentary, you know, those are two projects that, you know, are still unfunded and are both bigger projects. So the hope is that it starts to create a ripple effect of interest, but also finding partners, so that we can find the support and the partnerships for these bigger projects that kind of build that momentum. You know, the graphic novel is something in particular that has a direct voice peer-to-peer, because it's written by you know, a middle schooler. I mean, Devin was 12 when she wrote it. So it's literally peer to peer, and has this collaborative power where she was 12 writing it. She has a Colombian illustrator, Mariana Prieto, who's based in New York. And so she has this desire to make it in two languages. The illustrator is Colombian, and so that it's really has this really authentic base in what we're trying to do. But it's, you know, very authentic, not only in a dual language, but also in that it is speaking peer to peer, which is very powerful. But then the documentary is based off of all of this field research that was Devin doing the interviews herself with all these leading biologists and scientists and conservation leaders and wildlife rangers. And so while the team producing the documentary are adults and kind of carving out the story that parallels the field research with the street art projects, telling the story of what happened, it was a 12 and 13 year old at the time doing the interviews. So it still is peer-to-peer in a lot of ways. And we're hoping that, you know, all these projects have this authentic, inspirational story of wildlife conservation that will speak to the next generation and really get really the Gen Z generation, to get inspired. Because this new generation, you know, Gen Z is not waiting for change. You know, they're really showing us. They're demanding it. Exactly. they're not waiting, and they're using technology in unique ways, and they're marching in the streets, and they are demanding that we take action now in a myriad of topics, whether that is, you know, climate change, whether it
gun
is
gun violence, mm-hmm. School shootings. That's the same thing. I knew that.
you know, It's really inspiring, and I think that it's about providing knowledge. It's about, you know, providing inspiring storytelling, and that we aren't talking down to Gen Z, but we're providing peer-to-peer storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say the common theme of all the interviews we've recorded so far has been how important the next generation is to this issue. Like, it comes up every single time. We have to educate the next generation. They are the ones that are going to make the difference. So, I mean, I just love what you're doing, because I think you're exactly right. People are going to be moved by someone of their own generation who's young, able to achieve all of this and put out the word. It's going to be more meaningful to them as they receive that information. It's incredible. So I have a question about the documentary, because I want to make sure we talk about that. So you went off for 15 months around the world, and Devin's, you're interviewing all these people. What's the goal? Like, what was the hope for the field research, and what kind of questions are you asking, and what's the through line for the documentary?
With the documentary, so we were traveling for a year through my seventh grade. Through my seventh grade year, I was traveling for 15 months, like we said, through different countries, and I was really hoping that by doing these field research trips, I'd be able to learn all about the conservation problems facing different countries and the conservation solutions that other countries were coming up with, and how I could learn about them and why it was so important to get this education. And because I really, really wanted to share what I had learned with the world and be able to share all these new solutions and these problems, and hopefully people will learn more about it and be educated by it, and it'll encourage them to make a difference too. We want everyone to be making a difference, not like, oh, we're the ones making a difference, we're just making a documentary, you can watch it and then just carry on with your everyday life. No, it's like, we want this documentary to educate you so that you want to make a difference, and so that you will go out of your way to look up how you can make a difference. If we don't already give you those solutions, we're trying to share what we've learned in our knowledge and really put out those different interviews I've done with scientists and biologists and give that information and kind of show why that information is important to the fight for conservation.
So I think that what really comes through when you talk about those through threads is that throughout all of this, there's these global problems that all come back to local solutions, and that really the geography is different, but the solutions all have backyard applications. And what we started to find was that even though we're in Namibia or Borneo or Argentina, all of those things could come back to Colorado. And so what we wanted to show is that we were having this opportunity that not everybody gets. You know, we were really cognizant that we were incredibly lucky to have this opportunity, but that it doesn't mean that you have to go halfway around the world to make an impact, and that really we shouldn't. We really need to be looking at what is the solution in Breckenridge? What is the solution in Detroit or North Dakota or, you know, wherever you are living? Because these wildlife conservation issues, these climate change issues are all backyard solutions.
So can you give me an example of some of those backyard solutions? Like, what's something that you saw that you thought, oh my goodness, this is coming up everywhere we go and we're perfectly capable of doing that in Colorado?
So probably just some of the community-led conservation I've seen of getting the whole community involved and being able to use, the people around you to help you make a difference. Like, don't need to get people from crazy places around the world to educate you and to work together. You can just use the people around you to help. And everyone can make a difference with whether it's small everyday decisions like plastic use, less pollution, and then also just, like I said, with the community-led conservation, getting your local communities and local places to help work together, get restaurants to use less plastic straws, changing that community as a whole to make it more eco-friendly, and like using more carpools, less plastic, less pollution, as like basically the little solutions that you hear all the time, but getting whole communities to do it, not just one person at a time, getting more people, the better, honestly, just getting as many people as you can to make a difference and getting them to encourage their friends to make a difference. And yeah, the whole
and while
ripple
it's,
effect.
Yeah. And while it's individual change, it's about getting what, you know, what Devin's saying is getting then your individuals en masse, a lot like voting.
Yeah.
You know, while you want your individuals to know that they can make a difference, it's about then getting your block together. And a lot of it then comes down to looking at what you can be doing on a local political level. And a lot of what we're looking at too is remembering that when youth turns 18, they can run for local office. They can, you know, they can vote. They can be running a lot of times for local offices, which means they can be affecting political change at a what it seems like a very young age. So we need to be really rallying youth vote for 2020 elections around climate change issues, around conservation issues, green issues, you know, water rights issues, land right issues, because all of those things are affecting wildlife and environmental change.
Yeah.
And I think we see that a lot now with, you know, Protect Our Winters, which is, you know, climate change and what they're doing to rally young voters around individual issues that we can be looking at in terms of climate change is huge. And I think we need to be looking at that more now around biodiversity and wildlife conservation, because they tend to be really kind of antiquated and slow around how they reach out to youth.
It's really interesting what you were saying about the idea of taking this idea of, you know, every little thing that we individually do makes a difference and actually creating a mass experience of that, because I think it's really easy as individuals, like I'm just thinking even about myself, we have little paper straws that we take everywhere so that we're not using plastic straws. And it's really easy when you're doing that to think that, am I really making a difference? Like, does this really matter? But I love the idea of taking that one person doing this one thing and getting a whole group on board, because now you see that change. You see the scale at which your simple single choice is working, and you're creating that community effort in a completely different, I think it just completely changes the choice. It makes it so much bigger.
And it's the same with the opposite way, like with the problems, like one person using a plastic straw is like, oh, I'm just one person, I'm not making a difference. And then you have 7 billion people around the world saying, oh, it's only one straw. Like, it's the same the other way around. It's, and you can kind of use that being like, oh, it's 7 billion people around the world saying only one straw. Well, what if 7 billion people around the world are saying, what difference am I making using a reusable straw? Like, when we bring our stainless steel straws around the world, how does that make a difference? But then you think about, what if we got like thousands of people doing that? Then you really can see the difference.
And I remember when I saw a big shift, I would go to Mountain Film every year out in Telluride. And several years ago, Mountain Film was one of the first places I saw shift to, they wouldn't provide any disposable utensils for their picnics, for their group activities. They didn't have disposable plates, glasses, or silverware. So you were expected to purchase or bring your, and they had them there for sale. And if you were a filmmaker, you were given your own set of reusable, like a reusable spork and a stainless steel pint glass and a plate. And this was probably like almost 8 years ago now. And it, you know, people at first were like, it was real shift. Like, it was really hard for people to get used to that, to remember to bring it with you all the time because you're going to films and you're doing these things. But, and it's a lot of very kind of high, well-known filmmakers that would come to this. So it was a huge shift. Now it's normal. Like, nobody expects to show up to Mountain Film and not have your spork, your stainless steel mug, your pint glass, you know, your whatever. That became normal. And that's an entire film festival. So, you know, you can shift behavior. And then you start to do that en masse. But that means that then everybody who comes to that film festival automatically has that behavioral shift in their psyche for the other things that they're doing outside of Mountain Film. And so if all of those sorts of venues would start to do that, everyone who attends those venues starts to shift their psyche.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I know we see it, Eric and I, here in Seattle. Seattle's quite forward thinking when it comes to this stuff. There's lots of restaurants where there are no straws. People, you're just not even offered one. Same kind of thing. A lot of the disposable stuff is compostable, and that the whole mindset here, I can feel the change. So I think you're totally right. I would love to know, as you met with all these experts and these activists along the way and these scientists, who had the most impact on you and why?
For me, it was a difficult one because I interviewed so many people. But I really liked interviewing Dr. Lori Marker of the Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia. She's just so interesting to talk to, and she's just such an incredible person overall. And I love the animals she worked with. And Namibia was one of my favorite places to travel to. So it was just all of this together just made it such an incredible interview. And since we got back to Breckenridge, we met up with her in Denver one time a few weeks ago, and she was up here. We got to see her again. So trying to keep that connection was really cool. And it's just the solutions that she has created for the Cheetah Conservation Fund are just so interesting. Like, they use guard dogs and give them to farmers so that they can use those to protect their livestock against predators so that they can avoid wildlife and human conflict. It's like the things that is going on at Cheetah Conservation Fund is so interesting. And it seems like it is such a smart way to do it. Like, why haven't other places thought of it as much? And it's so interesting also how many people have been connected to Cheetah Conservation Fund. Like, most of the people, not most, but a lot of the people we've talked to or interviewed, they have been like, oh yeah, I was at Cheetah Conservation Fund for a year or a few months interning, which is so cool. And just learning how many connections she has, and she's just so influential, and it's just really incredible to be able to talk with her.
Amazing.
Yeah, she was one of the first women to, she's one of the leading female scientists to do what she's doing, and has set up, this incredible genetics lab in the middle of Africa. It's truly innovative what she's doing.
And she was one of the first people to really work with cheetah conservation and with cheetahs in general.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. Wow. And so was there a spot in the world? I know you said you really enjoyed Namibia. Was there a spot that was the most moving, that where you felt sort of the most called to action or the most sad or any kind of emotional experience? And was there a place that was the most shocking?
Well, all three research trips that I was on, Namibia, Borneo, and Argentina, they were all, like, very shocking or challenging in their own ways. Namibia was probably, like, my favorite and the most moving to me because I felt very connected to Namibia. And there was the animals that I loved, the place I loved to be. And I got some amazing experiences with wildlife. While I was at Cheetah Conservation Fund, I got to help feed the captive cheetahs. We went tracking black rhinos and hyenas on foot. They're just such amazing experiences. But then, like, while I was in Borneo, it was shocking in a different way because it was, for me, very, very scary, and I wasn't expecting it because I had to face so many fears while I was on that trip, like the saltwater crocodiles. I'm really terrified of spiders, and they have giant blue tarantulas. And then we went into this cave full of cockroaches, and there were just so many things there that I wasn't expecting.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was very,
awful.
Very scary. It was.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, no, I don't like thinking about it.
Borneo's the one place that she said she doesn't want to go back to, and yet
it was like an amazing.
She's like, I'm good.
Amazing. Yeah, exactly. It was an amazing field research trip, and I got this very cool experience where we went to an orphaned pygmy elephant sanctuary, nursery. There we go. Couldn't think the word. But that was so incredible, and there's so many cool things about Borneo. But then we went on the river, and we're out in the jungle. And that was a little bit past my comfort zone by a lot.
And yet our guide had been Sir David Attenborough's guide on two different expeditions. And so he had these incredible stories of guiding Sir David Attenborough. And I mean, so it was like mind-blowing how incredible this trip was. And we were at this incredible remote field research center of Denagarang, where these researchers and scientists spend years at a time studying wildlife and applying science to wildlife conservation. And Denagarang is this incredibly special, applied science research center. But it was also the place that scared Devin beyond her comfort level.
Yeah, I didn't know I could get scared.
Wow, that's amazing.
And, like, David Attenborough is, like, one of my personal conservation heroes. He is just so incredible. So I was like, okay, well, this is terrifying, but I'll just try to think about that and about David Attenborough. And then when we went in Argentina, that wasn't quite as shocking, but it was just really challenging because I had to do all the interviews in Spanish, which is hard enough since that's my second language. But also Argentinian Spanish is slightly different than the Spanish I learned.
Right.
It was pretty difficult.
And Shannon, do you speak Spanish?
I do not.
So your daughter was like leading the Spanish interviews in a language that you don't. Wow, that's amazing.
So it was interesting. And it's actually perfect that was the third trip, because, you know, we'd really worked out a lot of the kinks, especially with the doc. We had a film crew in Namibia and a film crew with us in Borneo. And then in Argentina, we didn't. Devin was kind of feeling a little stressed with camera crews and everything else. So in Argentina, I said, look, you know, I'll film everything. We're just going to learn. Like, we're just going to handle it all, and I'll take care of the interviews, and we're just going to make it a little bit more low key. And it worked out perfect because it was really a trust fall. And I just said, you know what? I trust you. You've now done all these incredible interviews under pressure with film crews. And so I filmed her doing the interviews, but I had to trust her that she knew what she got. So I would film and we'd be done, and she'd be like, okay. And I'd be like, wait, so did you get it? And she's like, yep. I'm like, okay, I guess we'll see in the transcripts.
Wow, that's so cool.
Also, because we weren't expecting it, we were expecting there to be some English speakers there. And then we get there and no one speaks English. So I'm kind of translating at the same time. And so then there was one of our guides, he knew a little bit of English, but not a lot. So he would tell me like a whole story in Spanish. And then, okay, he'd say, okay, now translate it for your mom. And I'd be like, ooh, okay. I don't know how well this is going to work, but we'll try.
Unbelievable. So I have to ask before we wrap up, and I want to make sure that we get to tell all the listeners how they can find your work and support it. But before we do, I have to ask you, Shannon, like mom to mom, how do you do this? Like how you have pulled your daughter out of school, so you're having to manage homeschooling, you know, giving her some kind of normal life experience with like friends and also follow these passions and interests. What is that like for you?
Well, luckily it was only 1 year, and it was shared with her father. So it was homeschooling back and forth. So, you know, she kind of had a little bit of a break from me, which was good. Where, you know, every other month she'd go and see her dad and his partner. She didn't have the normalcy, you know, of a social group. That I think was the toughest part of this, that we didn't anticipate, because it really was very adult focused. But you know, that part of it was hard. But it really was this choice, of wanting to deep dive into the field research, which was this opportunity that we never expected to have. And so it was also a chance to really break out and have immersive learning of deep diving into, you know, history and art and field research, you know, country by country, and being able to live in a way very nomadically, in which is, you know, the way that I have chosen to live my life before her. So it felt very natural.
Mm. And Devin, what's it like for you? And what are the benefits maybe to your relationship with your mom as a result of this? And what are the parts that are hard?
I think that me and my mom just became a lot closer over that trip. And we learned how to communicate. And, you know, I turned 13 over that trip. I was becoming a teenager. I probably was very annoying and frustrating at times, but so was she. So it's all good. We learned how to communicate. We went through some rough patches. And with my homeschooling, I was basically doing my math online, so like a course, which was really difficult for me. I had a lot of trouble really learning how to do it, and I would just not understand something. And when I didn't understand, it'd be basically like teaching myself, which was really difficult. But after that, like, I've done really well in math this year at school because I struggled so much last year. And just being able to have those experiences has helped me at school so much more than I could have thought it would. And being able to be surrounded by adults for a whole year. My social situation this year hasn't been great, but I've been able to do a lot better in other ways. And I've just been able to speak with my teachers more honestly and be able to communicate better with my school community and with my like friends of my parents that I'd known before. I was able to really understand how to talk to them better. And it just all became much more easy in that sense of things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I would imagine, like you kind of touched on, the flip of that is it must be really hard to reacclimate to hanging out with a bunch of teenagers when you've just had this very adult and worldly experience that's probably opened your eyes to life beyond whatever's going on at school.
Yeah, for sure. And before I went traveling, I was already pretty like open-minded and knew about the world because of my mom and because we had traveled a bit before that. And but when after that trip I came back and I had just been missing my social groups and my friends so much, and I came back and I just couldn't fit in at all. And it was just really hard for me. And a lot of my friends had moved on, and kind of learning how to get used to that again. And even though it was really, really difficult coming back to school because of that social situation, that also helped me learn of like, okay, well, this is kind of how kids are. You kind of learn what they're like. And for example, like getting bullied about my conservation work, like they just don't make sense. But they just, it's just different because I'm kind of don't fit in. I'm kind of different. And that makes that a lot hard to fit in with your peers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And the hope is that next year going into high school, it'll shift a little bit. I think you start to find your community a little bit better and realize that there are other people that care about conservation. There are other creatives. I think it's always tough for creatives. I know I've always struggled to kind of find my crew, especially in small towns. And being involved in social justice and working outside of this community, it always is tough to kind of find, your community. And when you care a lot about things, climate change, social justice, wildlife conservation, or in my case, women's rights before, I think it's always tough to find that tribe. But then when you do and you plug in with who your community is, then that tends to be pretty tight.
Amazing. So please tell our listeners, how do they find you? How do they follow you? How do they support you? Where can I get a copy of the graphic novel for my son who would love it? Tell me all the things.
Well, people can find us at endangeredactivism.org. They can follow our journey on Instagram is the best place to follow us, which is endangered_activism. And to get a copy of the graphic novel, at this point, the best place is to find our campaign through June 14th on Kickstarter. They can get a first edition signed copy and help support the campaign, which we would be grateful for, and help bring a new superhero into the world. And after that, it'll really depend upon how the campaign does, because it will be produced through indie publishing. So we won't know how that will be produced until after the Kickstarter comes out. But everything will be revealed on Instagram.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Devin, any final thoughts from you for our listeners?
Probably just that if there's any kids listening to this, please get involved in any way you can. You can make a difference no matter what age you're at. Everyone can make a difference. If you've got something you care about, then please go for that. You can do whatever you want to do. You can make it happen if you care enough. And
Google your favorite wildlife organization.
Yeah, you can do this. You can figure out you need to do this, and you can really make a difference if you want to.
Wow. Well, thank you, Shannon. Thank you, Devin. Just an incredible interview, and best of luck in all of your work that you're doing to change the world. I can't wait to watch it unfold.
Thank you so much for having us on.
Thank you.
Well, today's quote, I wanted to focus on young people and what young people can do, because I look at what Devin is doing and I am inspired as a grown woman. So I cannot imagine the inspiration that she will be for the generation below me. This is a quote by Jack Ma. Help young people. Help small guys. Because small guys will be big. Young people will have the seeds you bury in their minds. And when they grow up, they will change the world. Join us next week. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and Edge. Thanks for listening.